So you accept the pain, you call it by name, and then you do a tapping technique that helps you to ease your attention, negative attention, away from it. And it works. But if I don't do that, and if I just sort of try and blunder through, again, at 120 kilometers, that hip will be there and it will be more sore than before. So I find really stepping in and leaning into where the difficulty is, that it allows you to face it. You're not running away from the lion, you're running at the lion. And running, if you want to get eaten, run away from a lion. I'm from Africa. We get taught very early on, you do not run away from the lion. You either stay put or you run at it. That's your only two options.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Erica Terblanche. I can't quite decide how to actually describe our conversation in this introduction. Erica is an adventurer, and she is an ultra runner, and she has a curiosity and a joy about life that is just refreshing. Our conversation is a classic trail running conversation, one of those that you don't quite really know where it's going to go and what you're going to be talking about. That's why it's kind of hard for me to summarize what we said in just a short introduction. What I can say is that after we finished talking, I felt as if I now have a new friend. I hope that you feel the same way as you listen. Here's my conversation with Erica Terblanche. I heard someone say it this way. Somebody else said, he was asking the question, says, what did it take for you to, what did they give you to sell out your dream? And he said, your first job, in your career, what did they pay you? And that's really, he said, rather than doing the thing you wanted to do. How much did they pay you to sell out?
Oh my God, that is such a profoundly wham question. I hope it was worth it. Wow.
Yeah. So
I'm actually going to write that down. That really made, how much did they pay you?
My former brother-in-law, I was married to my sister for a while. He wanted to be a ski instructor, but his parents says, you need to be a lawyer. And so he was a talented artist, and he wanted to pursue art and he was miserable as a lawyer. He still is miserable as a lawyer.
Oh my God, that's the problem, because now you have the career of a lawyer, you've got the lifestyle of a lawyer, you've got the highly leveraged life of the lawyer, and now how do you let, in the Free State where I grew up on the farm, when we wanted to trap baboons, because they would come and raid the crops, you would put down pumpkins. You wouldn't even bother to really do anything to the pumpkins, but big pumpkins, the big ones. And you would make a small hole big enough to get your hand into. But once you make a fist, once you get a hold of the pips and you make a fist, you can't get your hand out. So, of course, the baboons would come. And honestly, I know it's a bit tragic, but that's what the farmers had to do to save the crops. You would trap a baboon like that, and it would give its life to just hold on to the pumpkin pips, a handful of pumpkin pips. And it's the tragedy. Once you're in that life, how do you get out? I was in it for 20 years of my life. I sold out. And then eventually I was like, okay, there's 20 years of maybe 40. Actually, maybe there's more left now. And I left. I left corporate to pursue my dream, but it's harder then. It's harder to do later.
Yes.
So I hope
because you have responsibilities. You have responsibilities, and yes, I know.
Exactly, exactly, and to not sell out the dream, you know. Yeah. So yeah,
and it feels more risky when you have those things that you feel like you could lose
completely,
and and it's more psychological. Absolutely. You know, the fear of loss. You know, I was talking about perception. I run barefoot, and so
wow.
I was running
160 kilometers barefoot.
Are you
training?
I did that. I was wearing shoes when I did that.
Yeah.
I've had a DNF at another 100 miles, so I did about 34 miles in sandals.
Right.
The trail, but yes. But on asphalt, I run barefoot. Mm-hmm. On concrete and asphalt. So I was running, and a lady told me. She said, "How?" You know, she said, "There's all kinds of glass on the sidewalk. How do you run barefoot?" Yeah. It was her perception. She'd seen maybe one or two pieces of glass, and in her mind was like, "I couldn't run barefoot because I would step on glass." I look, and there's maybe, you know, a couple places where there was a broken bottle and a few large pieces of glass that I could easily avoid. And so. Completely yeah. different perception. I'm like, there's plenty of space for me to run. I never have any problems with glass on the sidewalk.
It's psychological.
It is psychological.
It's a psychological impediment. And also the problem also becomes once you step into that echo chamber of being a successful lawyer, you now have a lot of successful lawyer friends. And it mm-hmm. becomes very hard leaving the norms of that place and to strike out on your own. I've got a cohort of very wealthy MBA friends, and it's challenging to stand in the midst there and saying, actually, I've chosen a different path. You know, you have to work at it a little bit. You do, you know, but mm-hmm. it makes you even truer to the path because you have to really stand by it, you know. When they pull up in their limousines or whatever, and you're on your bicycle.
And there's a fear, yeah. And there's a fear of failure. There's a fear of I might fail, mm-hmm. and that it's hard if you've never experienced that failure. Once you've done it, you realize, okay, I can survive. I can survive that happening. I failed as a real estate investor.
Yeah,
it was back in in 2006,
yeah,
they were loaning money to anybody who wanted to be a real estate investor.
That's right, before the bubble. Yeah.
The bubble. And then when the bubble came, I was not as bad off as some of the other people that I knew.
Yeah.
But I had four homes I was paying mortgages on, and only one of them was occupied, which was the one I was living in.
Right. Oops. Okay.
Yeah. And and then the successful business that my wife and I were in, our business evaporated, and we had it almost ended overnight. So we had no work, income,
four mortgages,
and three months of reserve,
right.
And so
completely.
I survived. I mean, we survived, and we prospered. It was tough. I mean, we had to live on less than half of our income, mm-hmm. and go through a couple foreclosures with the houses that we couldn't pay for anymore.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We came out the other end, and it was I would not want to do it again.
Yeah,
but it was like I look at that and it's like you can survive more than you think. And well, same way of outrunning. If you're out when you're out in a race, your body's telling you can't survive this, but you keep going.
But you keep going. And that's the beauty. You know, one never learns these things sipping a pina colada on the beach. You cannot. So having a business failure, a really difficult and frightening thing happen, it's in the frightening moments when you can't take another step in a race, where the real resilience comes. And I've turned it now into a hack in terms of, so when the pain really starts, when, so in the past week, I don't know if you're familiar with Comrades, It's very short.
I have heard of comrades. In fact, that's one that I've put in the back of my mind is that someday I'm going to go. Oh. I really would like to do it the year they go downhill though.
Yes, the downhill run is actually wonderful. I prefer the downhill. Yeah. They say it's harder actually, but I prefer the downhill. But so it was comrades, and definitely do come because it's a joyous experience of, it's like the Boston Marathon or the London Marathon, and the way people rise, you know, spectators mm-hmm. rise to the occasion. It gives you goosebumps actually. Anyway, so yes. I've just turned 51. And the narrative is, of course, and you have disproved this narrative, Eric. So, but that we should slow down now. But yes,
that again, that's like yes. That's a false perception.
That is a story we have been told, and why step into it if it's not true? So I approach running as a psychological endeavor, and I approach it with a lot of curiosity. I am curious about what may happen. So in South Africa, we've got a race called the 13 Peaks Challenge, and it's 110. Do you know it? Yeah,
Ryan. I read that you had done the 13 Peaks Challenge. I was going to ask you what that was because it sounds intriguing.
It's a 110-kilometer trail run, and it hits about 6,000 meters of ascent over this 110 kilometers. So it's relatively hilly, if I may say so. Mm-hmm.
yes.
And we did this on the Sunday and the Monday, and then flew to Pietermaritzburg to go and do comrades within the same week. And as a comrades runner, you get taught that you must taper for at least 3 to 4 weeks before the race. And tapering means that you don't run more than about 15 kilometers in that last 7-day mm-hmm. period before the race. So I thought, okay, it would be really curious to load the 110-kilometer trail run on the legs and see what happens in that place. So, of course, my comrades was a lot harder than a very rested comrades would have felt. And at mm-hmm. 15 kilometers, my legs already felt like they would normally feel like at 60 kilometers. But that was that beautiful thing, what we just described, that place of real difficulty and challenge. So it came for me at about 60 kilometer, at the 60, 70 kilometer mark. Because by now I had 180 kilometers on my leg in the same week. And when that difficult place came, the really difficult place where I struggled, where the pain was quite extreme, I was really tired, and you begin to think, gosh, how long still? I welcome it. I welcome the pain. I embrace it, and I say, ha, here you are. I had to run 180 kilometers to get to you. Thank you for being here because I know you are my growth point. You are my golden threshold, and if I step over this doorway, if I step into this doorway, on the other side is my unlimited potential, and I will get a bigger taste of that still. I'll be able to bring some of that into my life. So I use the pain as the place that says to me, ah, you've arrived at the growth point. And it's remarkable, then those 20 kilometers doesn't feel like hell like it normally would, but it feels like, mm-hmm. aha, okay, nice. This really hurts. This hurts like hell, but I'm having a good time because I know this is adaptive. So that's one of the hacks.
I love that. You know, I've heard things similar from other people that I've talked to on the podcast.
I'm sure.
Similar strategy of leaning into the pain. I mean, they've described it in similar ways.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, there's the other other strategy that people try to use of dissociating from
yes.
it and trying to block it out, to push it away. So have you experienced that? I mean, did you try to do that in the past and this is a new thing, or have you always kind of done the embracing and let's let it kind of lean into it?
So the thing is, what I know from my psychology background, and especially my positive psychology background, I talk a lot about emotional awareness and the ability to work through your emotions, because we know that which we suppress does two things. First of all, it grows. If we try and suppress it, it grows. And the second thing is it actually eats energy. So if you have a niggle in your hip and you are now at 60 miles and you're just trying to ignore the niggle in your hip, you know, perhaps for some people it goes away, but the science certainly, and for me personally, it doesn't go away. It just gets worse and it just sort of amplifies quietly, and soon it feels like your hip is coming out of the socket. But there is something called acceptance and commitment theory where when I guess this is what people mean when they say leaning into the pain, when you can actually allow the pain to be there, allow it, and then accept it, even call it by a name, accept it, ask it whether it has information for you. Perhaps you need to shift your stride. Maybe you're overstriding. Maybe your cadence is wrong. Maybe you're landing on the side of your foot where unconsciously. And, okay, if I just turn my toe slightly inward, then that hip pain gets a little bit less. So maybe it carries information. Maybe the information is, sorry, your hip is going to hurt for the next 100 kilometers if you're doing a 100 miler. And even if that is the answer, accepting it into your body and not fighting it anymore. There's even a tapping technique. I don't know if you know the emotional freedom tapping technique.
I have heard it referenced. I'm not familiar. Yes. With, couldn't say I'm familiar with it. I'm familiar with the
so
term.
It sounds horrendously corny. Forgive me, but honestly,
no. There are a lot of corny things. A lot of corny things that actually work. I mean, that's the thing.
Do you know, Eric? And I mean, if there's a place in the world to test this, that is at 100 kilometers into a 160 kilometer race, because yes. There is no proverbial BS happening there. It either works or it doesn't.
Yeah. So that's true.
The emotional freedom technique and how it works is it's a tapping technique, and where you tap on particular pressure points in the body, against the temple, against your wrist, also against the collarbone and your chest, and on your eyebrows and your chin, under your nose. And then you say the sentence, even though my hip is falling out of its socket, I love and accept myself. This is the corny part. But it's the acceptance and not self-judgment and losing precious energy, judging yourself for this pain that you are feeling, judging the pain, judging the fact that why is this happening? In fact, you reclaim the energy back, and then you do this tapping technique 10 times on each one of these meridians. And it also breaks the neurological circuitry, the where you constantly and obsessively begin to focus in on the pain in an unhelpful way. So you accept the pain, you call it by name, and then you do a tapping technique that helps you to ease your attention, negative attention, away from it. And it works. But if I don't do that, and if I just sort of try and blunder through, again, at 120 kilometers, that hip will be there and it will be more sore than before. So I find really stepping in and leaning into where the difficulty is, that it allows you to face it. You're not running away from the lion. You're running at the lion. And running, if you want to get eaten, run away from a lion. I'm from Africa. We get taught here really often. Do not run away from the lion. You either stay put or you run at it. That's your only two options.
That running, that's I've not heard of running at a lion. I did not know that was something that it was a strategy to, to keep from getting eaten.
But definitely not running away from. So that's, you know.
Well, we have here in the United States, we have they call them mountain lions.
Yeah. Are they dangerous? You know,
Yes. They're territorial. You know, They're cats. I mean, cats have kind of this psychology of, you know, there's an unpredictable aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But they say, you know, if a mountain lion, if you encounter a mountain lion, that you make yourself look big and mm-hmm. definitely don't run, you know, and that
you run. Right.
You make yourself look big. Yeah. Also, the other strategy, in fact, I had a podcast guest who encountered a mountain lion. She's very short. And so she says she actually started speaking because there's been scientific proof that the human voice is something the mountain lions don't like. And so right. Actually speaking, and she was, you know, she started just talking out, because she could hear it it was night, and she could hear it in the brush near her.
Yes.
So it was difficult. She wasn't sure which way she was moving away from it or toward it. So she just started speaking
I had a recent encounter with wild animals in that way. And people don't consider jackal, so the equivalent of foxes, as dangerous. I mean, I grew up with foxes, or jackal, as we call them here. Mm-hmm. And it was a 160-kilometer race in the Addo National Elephant Park. And the Addo Park is on the periphery of many other Big Five parks where there are definitely lions, rhino, buffalo, etc. And, you know, now you're running and you're alone in the dark for hours and hours and hours. You're basically running through the night. And I thought to myself, gosh, I hope the integrity of the fences in this area is really good, because if not, I'm going to be encountering anything larger than me that is perhaps carnivorous. Alone in the night is not a pleasant thing to think about. Eric, I hadn't had that thought. The thought hadn't yet cooled, and I saw in the distance slitty green eyes in the bush. You know when your scalp pulls onto a little tight prune, like when all the nerves mm-hmm. in your head. And I got to the animal that was actually a big jackal, and I yelled and I took a stick, exactly the same thing, run at the jackal and make yourself as big as possible. And about 10, he sort of very nonchalantly leapt into the bushes but disappeared. 10 minutes later, along the jeep track in the distance, I see a set of eyes again, and he had tracked me in the bushes alongside the road. To cut a long story short, after about an hour, there were 6 jackal.
Oh, wow.
They were scoping me out because I'm short enough and I'm small enough, and in a pack, they could have taken me. And maybe not, I mean, in that same hour, about 100 meters behind me, they took a young kudu calf, which is a young kudu calf is as tall as a man, and they ate the. But so running at the jackal helped. It definitely helped to chase them away. But I don't know what you do when a pack of negativity comes at you. I don't know where we're going with the conversation, but you really have to manage your mind when these things happen, because you're running, you're alone, and I really don't fancy being eaten as a way to leave this planet. I hope it's a more peaceful way.
Yes. Yes. Well, but that's one of those things that, you know, the risk is, you know, people put that risk really big in their mind, and, you know, even those encounters that you know, yeah. could, you know, could make some people say, well, I, you know, that's too dangerous. It's too much uncertainty,
yeah.
You know, because, you know, you said if the fence was down, it could have been a rhino or a lion, yeah. or, you yeah. know, there could have been other things out there, but, you know, there's always the fear of unknown.
Completely.
And
completely.
You know,
exactly.
The danger walking on the street from somebody who's not paying attention and they're looking at their cell phone, that's probably more. I mean, you encounter those dangers more than, you know, running out in the wilderness where, you know, animals tend to be afraid of humans.
Completely, and I'm so completely with you, because we overstate the dangers of these adventures. Of course, it can go wrong at some point or another, but we overstate them compared to getting in your car and driving down to the grocery store, statistically, you are probably 100 times more likely that anything will go wrong in traffic than in the wilderness. So I agree with you. We completely overstate these risks. And I think people are very often, as humans, we are, it's our limiting beliefs that keep us trapped. It's the limiting yes. beliefs. It's this sense of our capacity being so finite. And every single time I've gotten to that finite place, and if I just fed myself and I watered myself and I made sure I wasn't hypothermic and put clothing on, and if I was completely shattered, to just cut the pace or sit down, every single time I reach that place, I know there is this unlimited reservoir. When you think you cannot anymore, you get there and then, oh my God, actually, I can still, and you continue. So it's about the belief. The people tell me that, I mean, I know this. If it's a 40 kilometer, if it's a marathon, you get tired at 35 kilometers. If it's an ultra marathon, you get, if it's going to be 56 kilometers, you get tired at 48. How strange. But at 40, you're still absolutely fine. If it's a 160-kilometer race, you get tired at what? At 130Ks. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. And it's about the mental projection of the path.
I call that mile 73.
Tell me more.
It's about that point in a hundred mile race. You get to mile 73, and that's where you're at that point of, I made up the number. It could be 70, could be, but
completely.
I call it mile 73. You hit those points in life as well. And I said, going into a 100-mile race, you need to have a mental strategy for mile 73, because physically you're able to finish the race, but that's the point where your mind tells you it can't be done. And so that's the mindset struggle. And I said, that's where you have to prepare. You have to get some sort of strategy to get to that place and say, no, if I keep going, it will get better, or it may not. I mean, if I keep going, I'll make it to the finish.
Completely.
And that's the thing, whether it gets better or not, I'm going to keep going and get to the finish line.
So it's really interesting what different strategies different people use at mile 73. I'm just thinking of my own mile 73s when they come. To know that they will come, I think, is already a way to really prepare yourself that it will come. And all you need to do is to get to the end of it. You just need to get through mile 73. And like you say, whatever happens afterwards, it's almost irrelevant. Maybe it gets easier. Maybe it doesn't. But it's a non-negotiable, this commitment that you've made to finishing this race. Which is very interesting because as endurance runners, I think sometimes we skirt perhaps a thin red line. Maybe. So I got into trouble with some of my fans this past week, because I also had a chest cold while doing 13 Peaks and Comrades. And I know my body fairly well, and I had a pact with myself that if my heart rate didn't cooperate and if the race became dangerous for me, I would pull out. But I think there are times when the temptation to never, ever quit. You know, I always say the strategy should be never, ever quit and don't die. Those are the two primary rules of endurance racing, and not necessarily in that order. So
yes, that's true.
I think sometimes we get very close to a line in terms of, and yet again, I say that, and I don't really even believe that. And what I hear is the narrative of fear from people outside saying, how could you do that? Why could you do that? Maybe it wasn't safe. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, where should we not? Because I think we can literally run ourselves until we die. I do think so. I think we can actually keep pushing the envelope until we fall down dead. So where do you begin to hold back? You know, where is that thin red line? And does it just not exist? Can one just continue? Are we just, you know, one of our famous authors, Tim Noakes, perhaps you've even interviewed him, talks about the central governor theory where your brain shuts you down because it knows, the brain shuts the body down because it knows that actually, if it doesn't, you will just continue to drive the body until demise.
Yes.
So I'm curious what you think. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with that.
Yeah, the central governor theory. I've read about that, and it's that and typically the adjusting that governor to give yourself a higher level of performance. But you know, there is still that you can harm yourself. I was thinking of every time I try to recall a name, it's just like
tell me who she is.
He's an athlete. He did Moab. He did the Moab 240. He got lost. He damaged his lungs, and the doctors told him you have to be below Tim Goggins. He drives his body. He drives his body, and it's, you know, he has a whole different you know paradigm of how to accomplish these things. And so he went out to finish, even though he was, you know, he was disqualified for having to leave the course. And the doctors had warned him, you have to be below 5,000 feet or you're going to damage your lungs. And he went out and did it anyway,
right,
just to kind of prove that he could, that he was that tough. And that's his mindset, you know, to be tough.
Did his lungs get damaged?
He made it. He was okay.
Right.
And so he recovered, and he's still off doing you know more. Yeah.
Right.
But his approach is drive your body. The mind drives the body, and he's kind of set. You know, he's kind of disabled that central governor in his mind.
Fired him.
I have a different approach that I, you know, kind of similar to what you talk about of leaning in, accepting, and of nurturing, I guess I say nurturing the body the mind of, you know, the being present within your body and getting feedback as you go, it actually gives you, it's a more, gentle approach.
Yes.
And so what you talk about, those niggles, those pains, as you go along, if you're in this kind of state of being present, of accepting what comes, the pains will come and go.
Yeah.
And so they don't, you know, you can have the pain. You kind of just say, oh, there it is. And you just kind of just, you know, there's a grace, there's a sense of gratitude, I guess is what I say. That having that sense of gratitude, I'm here, I get to be here. I'm, you know, that, and letting the pain kind of come, not try to fight it, not try to suppress it, just let it come and realize it's also going to go.
Yeah.
And so that approach, I mean, very similar to what you said of just what can I learn from this? An acceptance of the pain. And other runners that I've talked to, that is a healthier approach to pain. So you asked the question you asked is about the red line. Where is that point? I don't know that we know. And
yeah,
you know,
that's the
curiosity. Because in my experience, you know, exhaustion, you know, true exhaustion, the fact that I can't go any farther will happen before death. But in my 50-mile race, I did run across a man who had a heart attack and died on the trail.
Oh, right. And
I mean, he was like 3 minutes in front of me, and I, you know, I got there shortly after he collapsed.
Wow,
so,
sorry.
So my wife was afraid the same thing was going to happen to me when I ran 100 miles. And so she would always tell me that was, you know, you said the strategy is don't die. Yeah. She always said that whenever I go to a race, don't die.
Don't die.
It's kind of
rule
thing.
Number said, one. Don't die.
The rule number one. Although I told her, I said, you know, the brain can't process a negative. And so I said, don't. Let's rephrase this.
Yes.
I said, you will survive this race.
Completely.
Said, that's the mantra. Yeah. That's the mantra I want. Come back home alive.
That's exactly.
It's Is it because just this in psychological terms, the things that you focus on that you don't want, your brain doesn't have the filter of the negative and will bring you actually the things you. So I said, when it comes to death, I'm like, I don't want death, but I'm going to focus on staying alive.
Staying alive completely. So, and the question is actually, if one had to go along your normal daily pursuit and perhaps you were in the traffic in your car and that was the time that your heart had an aneurysm, you know, perhaps it would happen anyway. You know?
It would happen.
People die at their desks, they die in the bus, they, you know. So to say that somebody died because they did a 50-mile race, one can't quite make that causal link. They died doing is what you can say.
Yeah. He died happy. He was doing what he loved. He was doing what he loved.
And going to go. So.
Yeah, and from what we heard later that we heard from the family that his uncle it was a family hereditary heart condition that was that was undiagnosed. I mean I had a friend who almost died from a similar thing. It was a blockage in his heart that didn't show up on any of the scans, and they finally found it and they told him. He said, "Well, this is the heart condition that kills people that they don't know about."
Completely, exactly. I've heard of that, and it has nothing to do with running. Actually, a friend of mine brought me some illuminating studies because there's been long since but some scientific research on heart health, and it started, I think, during when what's the book about barefoot running?
Oh, Born to Run.
Born to Run, exactly. During the Born to Run era, a lot of research was done on heart health and endurance runners. And there was one seminal study that came out that suggested that endurance runners' heart health was similar to the heart health of people who were completely sedentary. And that there was a sweet spot before endurance distances of running, sort of, I think it was 10Ks three times a week, less than 10 kilometers three times a week and less than 10 kilometers an hour, so 6 miles an hour pace. And actually the latest research that's coming out is completely discrediting that research, suggesting that actually the key to longevity, to huge, abundant and healthy heart, and also the rest of your physiology, is to keep your VO max as high as possible, VO2 max as high as possible for as long as possible. So if endurance running makes you do that, and then they talked about the mitochondrial renewal that happens in endurance running. So actually the latest research says that endurance runners are going to live a very, 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 very long time. And that it's for longevity. And this is what I'm beginning to find, Eric, now that I've gone into the third, fourth chapter of my life, if you want to call it that, stage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so excited because, yes, there have been physiological changes, but certainly not the physiological changes that suggest that I should stop and hang up my distance running boots. Quite the contrary, actually. I'm very excited about that.
Did you know that there's a part of your brain specifically designed to keep you stuck in a rut? It's called your amygdala. The other name we call it is the lizard brain. It is the most, they call it the most primitive brain. Your lizard brain is in charge of what people call the four Fs: feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproduction. Your lizard brain has no rational thought. It does not respond to logic. Your lizard brain's only concerned with survival. Your lizard brain asks one question: what is out there that will kill me? And anything that is outside of whatever is normal in your life, your lizard brain considers to be a threat. Yes, even bad habits. That's why bad habits are so hard to change, because any change that you try to make, your lizard brain is going to resist because it's new and different. So when you want to try something new, your lizard brain is that clinch in your gut that will keep you in your comfort zone. Now for runners, the distance oftentimes, it's the next distance that seems too far. If you're running a 5K, it seems like a half marathon. If you're running a half marathon, it's the marathon. If you're running the marathon, it's, well, do I even have what it takes to do an ultra? That anytime you're trying to do something, make progress in your life, like even with a career, if the lizard brain will say, don't take the risk of getting a new job. Don't take the risk of getting a job you might have to move out of town. Don't take the risk of trying to start your own business. Heavens, no. If you're happy in your comfort zone, your lizard brain will give you no problem. But if you want to make any kind of changes in your life, you have to get past your lizard brain. So there are mindset tools that you can use, and that's what I do as a coach, is help people overcome that resistance, that inner resistance to doing new things. I can help. I can help you get started. I offer a free 25-minute conversation. If you contact me, if you go to ultramindsetpodcast.run, ultramindsetpodcast.run, you could schedule a free 25 minutes. I can help you get started, make that first step to getting past your lizard brain, that resistance that tries to keep you stuck in a rut. Contact me now, ultramindsetpodcast.run. Schedule a time to talk to me. Yes, they call her the Iron Nun, Sister Madonna Buder.
Right.
And she's doing, and I saw, because I'd heard about her several years ago.
Yeah.
And then I just recently saw she completed a triathlon again. I don't know if it's a full Ironman, but I think she's 90, in her 90s. Completed her. I didn't read whether it was a full Ironman, but she, yeah. She was 86 when I found out about her.
Yeah.
And she had, you know, she does the Ironman in Hawaii at 86. And so, I looked at her and I went, okay, you know, I started running at 60 years old. I've got a good long time.
25 years, babe. Absolutely. Yes. I agree. And I think the more we stay healthy and fit at this very high level, the more vitality you have, the more energy you have. Energy begets energy. Then you have enthusiasm for life. And I remember when I was a child, we had a tablet called Solusa 45. There was an advertisement for people who are now old. And it was a tablet that you should start taking when you hit 45 years of age, because that's when the end is sort of nigh, you know. And coming 45 now, you're practically still a child. So, you know.
Yeah. I know.
Yes. And people are going to easily live to 120. The 120-year-old centenarians have already been born in spadeful. So I really do think we should rethink how we think of longevity, of health, of the ability of people who get older. And I mean, you look at the centenarians, the blue zoners. It's in Ikaria, the Californian Adventists. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know of them. And in Okinawa and Japan, they're 300% more likely to live 100 years and older than anywhere else in the world. And they have very, very active lives. They still mm-hmm. cultivate the land. They move by themselves. They're walking far every day. So this idea to go and sit in a retirement home and sit is a very bad idea.
Yes. Well, and I was at a conference and they were talking about the blues owners and they told the story of one of the men in California who had a price for building, for putting a fence around his property. It was a wooden fence. And whatever it was, he said, well, that's too high. I'll do it myself. And he was 94. And so he's building the fence. And then, 2 days in, he had to go to the hospital. But not for what you think. He had to go to the hospital because he was still an active heart surgeon and he was called in for an emergency surgeon perform an emergency surgery.
What a story. Oh my God. That is a beautiful story. And exactly. Why on earth should we retire? Tell me why.
Yes.
If you now have the wisdom of being on this planet for 80 years, you have accumulated, hopefully by then, the emotional maturity and the empathy that you really want to make a difference in the world. And you're still excited with life and have high energy. Why should we retire? Which is, of course, a problem if one thinks that the world has been built for a pyramid structure. Mm-hmm. And the issue is with young people coming into the workforce now, and we have a population structure that's looking more like a, you know, like a column, you know, how do they get into the workforce? But I mean, this is a whole other topic.
Yes, it is.
You and I have time straying way far from running. But I guess the question for me is one of, it's not so much about winning anymore. It's not about the performance of the sport. It's the ability to maintain and to still continue. That for me is really the emphasis going into the third and fourth chapter. And that's where the excitement is for me, to see psychologically, physiologically, where the body will go over the next 40 years. I'm curious.
Yeah. Well, me too. And I'm excited about it. I told people, I feel like I'm just getting started.
Wow.
I mean, it took me, I mean, I struggled with the limiting beliefs that I, you know, that I'd had from childhood all the way through until, you know, until now, just a few years ago.
Wow.
And it was like those beliefs really held me in a mindset that kept me stuck. And once I changed those beliefs, you know, and I tried, I mean, I knew they were there. I kept trying these things. And once I finally found a way to really get to my subconscious and convince myself that I could succeed, then it unlocked this. And I'm like, oh my goodness, my whole life's ahead of me. And, you know, and I'm looking at my life at 100, you know, looking at 120 years, I'm like, you know, at 100 years old, I'm, you know, I'm going to enter a 100-mile race at 100. Yes. I mean, that's my plan.
Okay. So, I'll be 90. Yep. I'll come to the same race.
I would love that. Now, it's probably going to have to be a 48-hour race that, you know, a timed event because my pace may not, you know, make the cutoff for, you know, for a 30-hour 100-miler. Yeah. That's my plan is that 100 at 100. So
That is so inspiring, Eric. And I'm actually really glad that I met you because I think more of us should talk this language and shift the narrative of what it means to age well and what is possible. So I'm really inspired that I've met you. So that's
well, I appreciate that. Well, and you're an inspiration to me. I mean, I look at, and I was going to, you know, part of the reason I went to talk to you about all your running adventures. And
right.
So give a couple of, I mean, you've done, I guess what was the spark? You said you started, after all the things you've done, I kind of thought that maybe you started in your 20s and that you just kind of had this life of adventure that you've gone on. But you said you've really packed it into the last 20 years.
Yes.
What was the thing that made you go, What was the internal thing that said, okay, I really need to change what I'm doing and go
completely.
And you went all in. I mean, you've done adventure racing and multi-day trail runs through the desert and all kinds of,
So it's very interesting. I think I was never driven by sport achievement. That's never been my cup of tea to see how hard or how far, how fast. Perhaps how far, because I'm curious. But the thing that really got me back in there was were two things. I have always loved nature. I've always had a passionate love affair with being out in the wilderness. I grew up on a farm. I remember the feelings of belonging out in nature and feeling a bit more like myself, you know, when I was in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, what was the sentence you used earlier? How much did they pay me to sell out?
Yeah.
I became a land surveyor because I wanted to be out in the wilderness. And just for listeners, surveyors are those people you see standing behind a theodolite, measuring pegs in the ground or setting out dams or setting out earths. But it's an outdoor job. And I was an article student and I had very little income and a huge student debt. And a big international consulting firm picked me up and offered me literally 20 times my salary, which was very little at that point in time. So it was a low base, but I couldn't say no. And then I moved to the city and I left surveying and I became a strategy consultant for similar of the likes of McKinsey and Bain. And I suddenly spent 18 hours a day in the office. Never saw the sun anymore. And of course, you get into the culture of afterwards, you know, the sun is down anyway. You're in a city. What are you going to do? You're going to go to the pub with your mates. Late nights in the pub and then back to the office, early morning, 18-hour days. And, you know, eat, drink, sleep, repeat. Eat, drink, sleep, repeat, you know. And so it became a very unhealthy lifestyle. And the more I got disconnected from nature and the city, the more this uber drunk grew to get back into the wilderness. And I think I was just like a caged animal waiting to rip free. And when I saw the Eco Challenge on TV, it was an adventure race in Fiji. I think it was the Eco Challenge of the Fiji year. And I saw this team of four people out in the wilderness day and night, doing these incredible things. I literally remember getting goosebumps and I knew this was it and it was my sport. And adventure racing had just started in South Africa at that point. And I gathered together and by then I'd left consulting and I'd gone to do an MBA. And I got together a few of my MBA colleagues and we did our first 24-hour race. And you will remember when you did your first 50-miler, that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, when we went into the night and it was about 3 a.m. and we were coming through this thick undergrowth in these incredible Drakensberg Mountains in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, I just fell in love so hard and I married the sport. Immediately, I even describe it like that in the book. And then I just threw everything into it, heart, body, and soul, and adventure raced myself silly for 5 years. Put all my money into it, all my spare energy, all my time, and then eventually went to adventure racing world champs in, you know, 5 years later. So it really became... It became my avenue into endurance sport. And then I retired and I picked up trail running. I tease. But you know, once you've stayed awake for 5 nights and 5 days with maybe 2 hours sleep after 3 days of being on your feet and learning how to, that the human animal can actually sleep while walking, fast asleep. You can actually sleep while you're on your feet. Once you do that, then when you go and do trail running, there's this deep gratitude that, you know, even if you do an all-nighter, that it's just for one night. This is what trail running also does, is when we do these 160-kilometer races, you push the boundaries of the possible out so far that something that other people would find really challenging, difficult, and fearful becomes easy and manageable, or maybe not easy, but manageable.
Manageable. It becomes you look at that and go, that's totally within the realm of, I mean, it's totally doable. I mean, it's a big challenge. You may not finish. There are a lot of things that can happen.
Exactly.
But it's like, I can do that. I know I can go out. I can put in, you know, I can put in the time, and, you know, if I do it right, if you know,
yeah,
everything works out, I can get to the finish line.
Yeah.
And it's not an impossibility.
Exactly. I guess the inquiry for me right now is, how does one shift limiting beliefs? And so one way is to push the boat out so far that you couldn't have imagined, so that when you come back to a norm, say, it becomes manageable. So that's one way. And another way of pushing out limiting beliefs that I think really, really helps me is to begin to shift in your... It's almost like before, I really remarked that when you said, when you decided you're going to do that 100-mile race, you had already become a 100-miler a year before you even entered that race in your head. So there's mm-hmm. something about, at the level of identity, already going, actually, you know what? I mean, I'm doing something so scary in the next... after I'm going to run in the desert, and then I've signed up for something that scares the living daylights out of me. I swim like a stone, really. A kilometer, mm-hmm. I don't float. And I've just signed up to swim to Robben Island. It's an 11-kilometer swim over the Atlantic Ocean with lots of great white sharks. But I am beginning to tell myself, I am a swimmer. And then my body, my mind goes, no, you're not. You're not a swimmer. Then the strategy,
I'm familiar with these conversations.
No, my mind is like, don't be ludicrous. When last were you in a pool? So now I ask myself the question, why am I a Robben Island swimmer? And even the psychology supports this, that if you ask these almost mantra statements as a question.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say, mm-hmm. why am I wealthy, or why am I successful? Or I mean, you don't say I'm successful. You ask the question, why am I a Robben Island swimmer? Because then your mind doesn't fight the fact that the fact is absolute BS. Your mind immediately, it's trained to immediately go into problem-solving mode. And then you begin mm-hmm. to give yourself reasons, because I'm going to get up tomorrow at 5 a.m. and I'm going to go swim 3 kilometers. That's why I'm a Robben Island swimmer, because then your mind begins to problem solve, and you actually fall upon the habits that you need to become that thing, and it creates the pathway. So that for me is another way of shifting these limiting beliefs, is to actually, at the level of identity, ask, why am I an X? Why am I a 100-miler? Mm-hmm. Because I'm going to mm-hmm. get out there and surround myself with the people who will make it happen. Because I'm going to show up consistently for my training. Because I'm going to sign up for a race and work towards it. And then because I'm just going to go and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And listen to podcasts like Eric's to motivate me that it is possible. It is possible.
Yes. Yeah. And it starts with imagination, because a lot of people, when I, you know, they found out I've run 100 miles, they say, I can't imagine running that far. And I'm like, that's why you don't.
That's why you don't. Yeah.
And so, it starts with the imagination, you know, and, you know, I didn't realize it when I looked at my friend's 50-mile race and said, that looks like fun. You know, I bet I can do that. That put in my imagination, that placed it in my imagination, and I started thinking about what was possible.
Completely. You know,
and that was for the, because it is, it's until you've done it, it's an imagination. It's an image in your mind.
Completely.
for what you want.
Yeah.
And that's an imagination is different than dreams. A dream is different. Imagination actually puts you there. Imagination is you're experiencing it beforehand. I mean, there's a lot of psychological principles, you know, but I've always been a dreamer, you know, but when I'm dreaming, there's a different psychological, there's something different going on inside my mind than when I'm imagining. you know, when I saw that goal and I was like, I bet I can do that.
Exactly. Your feet were in the shoes already. You were imagining, you were imagining it. And I guess that's why it's so critically important to inspire people to imagine big things, because everything that exists was once a thought first.
Yes.
And if you can't think a big thought, then the reality is going to be a small one. So to really allow yourself to imagine beyond and beyond, like living to 120, being lucid, active, and still surfing, you know?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's where, you know, I'm putting that in my mind, because I know people who are my age, they're done with life.
Completely.
And they're, you know, they think they've done everything that they were going to do, and they're just, kind of waiting for, well, they're just coasting. They're coasting. Mm-hmm. They're thinking they're going to coast to the end. And I'm looking at, you know, that I'm halfway through my life.
Completely, you know? There's still, thank God, there's still another half left. Thank the Lord, because there's still so much to do. And it's curious. I often in my practice, sometimes one asks people, you know, when you begin to talk about longevity and you begin to talk about this aspiration to live really long, to live to 120, I would say that probably 7 out of 10 people say, oh my God, I pray not.
I've heard that, yes.
And I mean young people even, like 30, 40-year-olds saying, I would not want to live to that age. And then you begin the inquiry of, is it because you wish to be vital when the end comes and not be frail and go into your... And then actually a more stark answer appears, and that's that people... perhaps sometimes don't taste the joie de vie of life right now. And that, you know, so I think it's also about getting the present right, getting your mind right for the now, turning your attention to what is good in your life, to what does excite, to learn this mental muscle. And I actually recently read that endurance runners, as a population, is better than the general population at reframing difficulty into the positive. Of course we are, because we practice it all the time.
You have to, yes.
Yes, you have to. Otherwise you're going to die out there. Not die in that way, but you're going to have a hard time. But this idea of getting your mind right for life, not just for distance running, to practice the gratitude, to practice the mental muscle of reframing, to look upon what is there rather than on the lack, to stop toxic comparison, all the things that drive us into wanting to snuff it out at 80 or 70 or being horrified at the idea of a life of 120 years. I'm always surprised by that.
Yes, and that's... Well, and they also, there's the expectation that with age comes debilitation, and that I'm not going to be, you know, that at age 90, you know, I'm going to be stuck in a rest home, a nursing home for years. And that is a lot of times that is the mental image people have with aging. And there are examples of people out there who are not, I mean, there are people I've talked to who are, you know, have been running for 40 years and in their 70s. Wow. You know, they've run every day for 40 years. And you know, I look at, say, you don't have to accept the narrative of, you know, what you've been told. And that's the narratives that we've been told are form our limiting beliefs and all of those things that we limit ourselves. And when you ask the question, why is that? Why do I think that's true? And what if it's not? What could I do? You know, that's it's amazing the things that are out there when you start opening your mind to start questioning those things that you've always believed.
Yeah.
And the thing that I found is that, you know, used to be afraid of the questions. Most of us, we like certainty. It's like, you know, I have my religious beliefs, I have my political beliefs, this is the way the world is, and I know everything that, you know, I know how it works, and I don't have to worry about it anymore. And then when something happens to knock you out of that and you start questioning, well, wait a minute, the world isn't working the way that I thought it. Yeah. It, you know, these things have come in that kind of call into question what I've always believed. We're afraid to question what we believe and readjust. And I came to the point where I was like, no, I'm going to go into this. I'm going to question everything. And I had one, you know, but one anchor point, you know, in my religion, you know, for my beliefs that God created everything.
Yeah.
And then I said, but everything else is up for question. What, you know, how does this work? And so I realigned myself, and it was a long process, but being able to say, I don't know, you know, maybe the world doesn't work the way I think it works. Maybe the things that I believe about this aren't true. And if it is true, then I'll sort that out. But I don't want to believe something that is false, or, you know, that maybe has a different angle, or that's I have learned to question a lot about my life. You know, what's possible for me? I mean, how far can I run? What can I do? You know, is it possible to live to 120? And I that was one that I looked at. I was like, yes, that's totally possible. It's only false belief that, you know, we have to degenerate and get, you know, less active. I may slow down, you know, I'm going to work and prepare myself for being 120 years old and running 100 miles at 100 years old.
You know, that's and you're creating that scaffolding. So everything in your life, all the energy, the attention, your planning, the micro decisions you make aligns to that vision. You know, positive psychology, we call it the heliotropic effect, that human beings, we tend to an envisaged future. So that's why it's so starkly irresponsible to not have a vision for your life, because you are such a rich resource. Somebody will make you their resource, whether it is the media companies or social media or your mother-in-law, but somebody's going to give you a future. So, and in the goal setting, I often take people into the wilderness and do Navigate courses where we do big dream goal setting, because it's very subtle, but every bit of your energy and attention then begins to align to this vision of Eric, healthy, well and alive, probably still working and probably still running at 120, you know, and why not?
Yes.
And in the absence of that, what's the other picture that society gives you, right? And it's really not a picture I want to ascribe to.
I've really come to believe that once I came to the fact that, you know, that God gave me free will and I could choose what I want for my life.
Exactly.
That I was like, okay, that means that the bad choices have brought me to where I'm at now. And if I keep making those bad choices, I'm going to have a repeat of the last, you know, 40 years, 40 years of choices that led me here.
Yes, exactly.
But the good news is that, well, I don't like where I'm at. I can choose to go somewhere else. I can choose to be different. I can choose a different life than what I thought I had, you know, what I thought was destined, you know, was destiny or fate or whatever. Like, no, the choice is up to me. And I have to decide, I have to choose and then go. And go get that.
And imagine something different and then follow that through. And, you know, I think that the reason why we have the narrative that we have at present about what aging looks like is because if you think about the baby boomer generation, I mean, highly sedentary office working lives.
Or factory.
Factory, office, all indoors. It's the era of refined foods, sugar, flowers, the dairy.
Wonder Bread builds both strong bodies 12 ways. I remember those advertisements.
We had one in South Africa called Shuhuga gives you energy, Shuhuga. And then
oh my goodness.
Parents giving a mouth spoonful of sugar to the child. You know, so okay, so that was a, and never mind the chemicals and the DDT and heaven alone knows the things that we were exposed to chemically, that people are now beginning to understand is very dangerous for us. So I think there is there are ways that we've lived in the past 60 years that has definitely capped our longevity. But like you say, one could choose now to live differently and to choose differently. You know, and often I listen to Sam Harris's podcast. I don't know if you're familiar with Sam.
I'm not familiar with Sam.
But. Yeah, but Sam Harris, he believes that there is no free will and that we would always have, I would always have eventually stopped going to the pub and entered in adventure racing. It was my path in life. It is just how I am wired. And I don't actually subscribe to that notion because I think there is a lot more free will in how you can choose to rewire your life and completely remake who you are according to what it is that you believe is important. So, you know, I think these are...
Yes.
And when you don't believe in free will, then you can't have radical accountability in your life. And
that's true.
And radical accountability is where agency lives. Without that, if I'm not accountable for how it turns out to the best of my ability, then why would I even bother? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I
came at that from I was brought up in a, you know, a religious home. And so the, you know, religious was, you know, God has a plan for your life. And so your goal is to find God's plan for you and follow it. And, you know, the way is narrow and, you know, you really have this, that's a mindset and a teaching in the church. And so when I came, it's like, yes, God has a plan for me, but it's like a broad valley between two mountain ranges, like head that direction. And anywhere in this valley you want to go is, you know, you just head that way, you know, and, you know, kind of like it's very much like an adventure race.
Completely. You can tiger line it. You can take whatever route you want. Yeah. So I also grew up in a religious home and I still believe. I believe in God, and I believe that, you know, I'm not sure about the plan, you know, and to find the plan. I don't have a view on that. All I know is I am accountable for the choices that I make, and I have been given the free will to choose, and I can make good choices or I can make bad choices, and accordingly will be the reality of my life. And also the mental choices I make, what I put my attention on, the kind of people that I surround myself with, that will be the reality of my life. So, but I do believe in some divine intervention. I've tried too many times in my life and something completely left field happened to answer those prayers. I've prayed too many times to disbelieve that there is something else going on.
And my relationship with God has become much more personal, and much more intimate, and much more free. And so there's a give and take. It's I tell people, you know, when you get married, you don't have a bunch of rules given to you that you have to follow. That, you know, here's what married life looks like. You enter into this relationship, and there's a give and take. And, you know, the way that we hang the toilet paper in our house was a negotiation. You know, like, does it come over the top or does it go down the wall?
And so
it was like, and, you know, it was like, okay, I hang the toilet paper differently than the way I was raised. You know, I was raised that it went. And so, but you know, there's just that give and take. And it was within the context of a relationship that my life changed because I value the relationship, and that's what I have now with my relationship with God, is that the things that I do aren't because of rules or fear of punishment or, you know, I value the relationship. So I work to maintain that relationship and realize that, you know, I have a lot of choices that, you know, I'm responsible for within that relationship. I mean, the same way with my, you know, my relationship here at home. I mean, the choices that I make, affect my relationship.
Completely. And yeah. Eric, what's very extraordinary to me is, and it's wonderful to have this conversation, that because of the rule-based and punitive nature of religion, mm-hmm. a lot of people have walked away from God because of religion. And and that for me is often the saddest thing. So in the end, all that remains is my relationship with God, your relationship with God, and the rules around it. You know, I mean, it's very clear in the book that I'm gay. And it was a real struggle for me to stay near God. In the beginning, I left church. I actually had to mm-hmm. leave church. That's actually my next book. My next book is called Pilgrim. And I've begun to write it. And it's this quest for actually the direct relationship with God, despite the rules and the orientations. And, you know, I had to find my way back to the church. Not to the church as much, because it was very difficult. But to find mm-hmm. my way back to a direct relationship with God in a way that allowed for me to live my life in this way. And it's not been easy. And very often when I speak to my friends, and I live in a very secular society, you know, people have a lot to say about religion, and it's negative, and I understand why, for good reason. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then the tragedy is then having lost God in the picture. I mean, that I think that's perhaps the greatest tragedy of our time, is that so many people have walked away from that great mysterious force that holds our lives together.
Yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It is. Well, I never know how these conversations are going to go. If you've ever run on a trail with someone, you know that's why I call this trail talk, is because I wanted to make it like a virtual trail run. And so, I've appreciated hearing your insights and your stories, and my intent when I first contacted you was to hear about your adventures, but I've valued this conversation. It's been great, and you've had a great life of adventure. Tell a little bit about who you are as your coach, and how people can if people hear this and want to connect with you, get your book. I mean, how can they get a hold of you?
First of all, I just want to say keep following Eric, because you're gonna get 60 years of podcast.
Yes. Actually, there may be more than this podcast in my future. So I don't know. I keep having ideas for things that I'd like to talk about.
Wonderful. So. And this excitement in life, you know, excitement with life, and this knowing that every day is a gift and making the very most of it. So I think that's so, that is generative and is going to make you live a very long life, is to be excited with life.
I appreciate it. I'll accept that. I'll accept that.
In my coaching, Eric, people can find me at thrive-guru.com. Thrive-guru.com. You can follow me on Instagram, my author page, Erica_Blanche. And like I said, there's a new book coming out. And in my coaching practice, the kind of people that find me are often people at career junctions or people that are at life junctions. And it's often people who want to get something done with their life, who, you know, they want to touch that agency. They want to touch that accountability. They want to get out and do something with their life. So that's mm-hmm. that's normally the coaching clients that find me. And that I'm privileged to work with. Yeah. So my background is, I'm a positive psychologist. I have a degree in psychology. I've got numerous coaching, certificates. And I'm also a systems coach. So I like working with teams. There's magic in working with teams. Mm-hmm. I've got 20 years of corporate business strategy behind me. And so I mix the endurance running, the positive psychology, and the business strategy, and then some nature immersion, and some interesting things come out of that. So it's quite a unique approach to coaching. So thank you for asking that. And I really enjoyed talking with you. It felt like a kindred spirit.
Yes, I felt that too.
Yeah.
That's the thing I've so appreciated this podcast is I've gotten to meet so many amazing people.
Yeah.
And just that for me is a gift. I enjoy sharing the stories that, and the insights other people have with the world and with my audience. So.
Yes, and I think people will get a lot of wisdom from it because of the approach that you take to this podcast. It's definitely different to any other podcast I've been on. So I'm very, very, soulful and not so much focused on the things that we've done, but more the people we've become because of the things that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I like that a lot.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you a lot for being here.
Thanks, Eric.
Oh, before you go, I have the bridge questions.
Oh, what's that?
The bridge questions are three questions that I ask at the end of the podcast. Okay. And so.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
You've got a lot of experience with different forms of both running and adventure racing. So, aside from shoes, which everyone thinks they have to have shoes. So, besides me, I don't. But most people would think shoes are essential gear. What is your essential piece of gear that you have that is the most valuable thing that you have to take with you?
And just FYI, I'm a little bit with you on the shoes. As long as my soles are covered, I'm happy. And the less covering, the better. So that's...
I'm right there with you. Yeah, sandals.
But so my favorite piece of equipment by a long shot, is my emergency blanket.
Okay. Yeah. That's the foil
blanket? Because that little... what is it, probably half a meter by 2 meters, have saved my life many, many, many times from not being here today. So in adventure races, hypothermia, in my emergency blanket by a long shot.
That's
good. In fact, I carry one when I go into town because I just don't want to die cold. So if ever anything ever happens to me, I'm at least going to be warm.
You've made me rethink my strategy because I've had the same thing as run by myself. I'm only a few miles from home, but I'm by myself.
Yeah.
And I thought, and I'm a winter runner, so I don't put on many clothes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I thought, if I'd sprained an ankle and be forced to be, out there for an extended period of time. And for a time I was carrying an emergency blanket, but I didn't last year. So I'm going to put that in my must-have piece of gear,
put it back. It's so tiny. It's so light and it can save several people's lives at once. It's a definite.
And they're cheap enough. You can buy several. So I'll put them in the cars.
Just a word of warning. After about a year, just check them before you go onto a race or something, because the dreadful thing that sometimes happens is you shake out at the emergency blanket because it's been in your cupboard for 3 years and the silver wafts away in the breeze and all you're stuck with is a piece of plastic. So they deteriorate.
Okay, so keep your emergency blankets fresh. So every year. They're cheap enough you can buy new ones every year. Okay, the second question. What is the weirdest thing you've seen when you've been out running?
The weirdest thing I've seen? Actually, perhaps not that weird. I've seen some incredible things, some beautiful things. I've run often with antelopes alone in the wilderness. It's in the book. But perhaps the weirdest thing I've ever seen is somebody who brought an entire film crew onto a desert race to come and film him. And it wasn't for any other reason but for him to be filmed. So I found that extraordinary. I mean...
I kind of admire his ego. I mean, that's a person with a lot of self-confidence.
No, because it didn't seem to bother him at all that he had this entire film crew following him. It's like, but anyway, that was interesting. Yes, exactly. And I mean, if you are a quiet runner and sort of not try and attract too much attention, and that would obviously be very weird for me. Interesting.
I could see. Well, I would feel weird too if it, you know.
Strike a pose. Okay.
That's funny. Okay, the third question. What is a word or phrase that sums up your philosophy of life?
You will recognize it if you read my book, but never, ever give up. There is always another chance. Never, ever give up. There is always grace. There's always another chance.
I like that. Yeah. So, and you can find your book on Amazon.
Is it
available on Amazon? Yep. Okay. Yep. Okay. Great. Well, I'll include a link for that.
Thank you. I really enjoyed
Erica. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Lovely. It was such a pleasure, and thank you for the good work that you do.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you know somebody who might like it as well, please take just a minute. Send them a link so they can listen. And if you enjoy most of the episodes, please tell your friends. That's the best compliment you can give. I truly enjoy being able to spend time here with you each week, and I appreciate that you take the time to listen. If you have any comments, questions, or stories that you'd like to share, go to ultramindsetpodcast.run, and you can leave a written or a voice message. You can also find the show notes for this episode and more at the same link, ultramindsetpodcast.run. Remember, it takes an ultramarathon mindset to go the distance in running and in life, and a strong mindset is a skill you can learn. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.